Greetings and liloteric remunerations, my graciously thanatonic listeners, and welcome to this July 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this bizarrely sybaritic science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome to the 8th year anniversary podcast of this segment. Yes, Starship Sofa has had the, pleasure of hosting the science podcast since July 2008. Yes, in terms of duration, this segment has been around a while longer than, Firefly, Babylon 5, the original Star Trek, and for that matter, the Star Trek Next Generation. So we're not doing too badly. And because it's our anniversary, no sidetracks tonight. Just nummy-nummy science stories. First story of the night. Exoplanets are blooming everywhere. Over 1,000 planets have been added to the roster of worlds known to orbit other stars in the Milky Way. Dr. Timothy Morton of Princeton University announced this in the May issue of the Astrophysical Journal. That, my friends, is the largest number of exoplanets yet announced at once. Most of the 1,284 worlds are larger than Earth, but smaller than Neptune. And many of those are probably just big balls of gas. But over 100 of the new discoveries are smaller than 1.2 times the diameter of Earth. And Morton says, quote, "Those planets that are 1.2 times the size of Earth are almost certainly rocky in nature," unquote. Nine planets also lie within the habitable zone of the star system. That's the distance from the star where liquid water could conceivably collect on the surface of the planet. The announcement roughly doubles the number of planets discovered by NASA's planet-hunting workhorse, the Kepler Space Telescope, which now has found a total of about 2,325 exoplanets. Kepler spent about 4 years staring at maybe 150,000 stars in the constellations Cygnus and Lyra, and watching for subtle dips in starlight as planets crossed in front of their suns. This planet bonanza comes courtesy of a new statistical calculation that allows researchers to feel confident that a detection is a real world. Imposters, such as companion stars, can mimic the signal of a planet. Traditionally, each planet candidate must be followed up with intensive observations from ground-based telescopes. But with over 4,000 candidates now in the queue, confirming each one, well, it will take a long time. This new calculation takes into account the details of how a passing planet should dim and brighten the starlight, along with how common imposters should be, and provides a reliability score for each candidate. Planets in Morton's study were those whose scores were 99% of certainty or greater. Those 4,000 planets will soon be dimmed by the addition of even more when the transiting exoplanet survey satellite, TESS, TESS, launches in late 2017. And then, some of those planets found by TESS will in turn come under the gaze of the James Webb Space Telescope, which will launch very late in 2018. I think it was originally meant to go up in 2013. I'm not entirely sure what the problem has been with that telescope. But the new Webb Space Telescope will make Hubble look like, well, something that you'd give to your kid to look up at the moon. The James Webb Telescope mirror will be made up of 18 mirror segments that form a total area of 25 square meters. That's almost 30 square yards. When they all come together, it will be 22 feet in diameter, and Hubble's mirror is just 8 feet in diameter. Well, next story. Is the body mass index utterly pointless? Well, perhaps it's not utterly pointless, but for years I have been saying that there is something seriously wrong with it. Even when I weighed a few pounds less, and quite healthy, my BMI indicated that I was obese and at death's door. Yes, I am making personal statements that have nothing to do with science, but it's hard for me to trust numbers that make healthy, slightly overweight people worry about themselves. Well, in a recently completed, almost four-decade-long study in Denmark, which was published May 10th in the Journal of the American Medical Association, The myth of the usefulness of the mass body index is finally shattered. The work was led by Dr. Bourge G. Nordestgaard of Copenhagen, and forgive my pronunciation if it's way off. The study found that obese people seem to be at no higher risk of dying than those of normal weight. The new analysis actually fuels the ongoing debate about what's a healthy body mass index, especially in light of rising obesity rates, improved heart health treatments, and other factors influencing health and longevity. In short, the BMI as a number alone may not be sufficient to predict health and the risk of death. It has to be taken within some sort of context. For those of you who do not know what the BMI is, let me explain. BMI is a popular but fairly crude measurement of body fat. The calculation is reached by dividing a person's weight in kilograms by the square of their height in meters. People with BMIs between 18.5 and 24.9 are considered normal. A BMI between 25 and 29.9 is overweight. BMI of 30 and above is obese. In this new analysis, Nordestgaard and his team studied more than 100,000 adults. The three groups of white Danes recruited about 15 years apart reflected the general population of Copenhagen. From 1976 to 2013, BMI associated with lowest risk of death increased from 23.7 to 27. That falls squarely in the overweight category. What's more, obese individuals have the same mortality risk as people in the normal range. That trend held even when researchers took into account potentially confounding factors such as age, sex, smoking, and even a history of cardiovascular disease and cancer. Nordestgaard says, quote, "Do not misinterpret our study to mean you can eat as much as you like. This is not what our findings suggest. Rather, the results indicate that people who are moderately overweight might not need to worry as much as they had in the past. So now maybe you can be overweight if you have high blood pressure and cholesterol treated, whereas in the past they would have been deadly," unquote. Part of the problem with this study, as you may have noticed, is that it's unclear whether the results apply to other ethnic groups. 100,000 white Danes will only tell you so much of a medical story. A substantial fraction of Asians, for example, develop type 2 diabetes and heart disease despite having BMIs lower than the existing cutoff point for being overweight. As I have insisted for years, though, the findings of this study underscore the idea that a person's BMI does not tell the whole story. While this measure is good for comparing populations, it is not as useful for evaluating individuals and their risk for disease and death. So, take that, BMI. Next story. You may remember a couple of months ago, I reported that someone had figured out how to hack 3D printers by recording them as they printed. This next story is very similar, and it's seriously disconcerting to anybody in computer security. So, what is the ultimate in computer security? How can you guarantee that no one can hack your computer? Simple. You air gap it. What does that mean? It means that the computer has no connection to any other computer, no Wi-Fi, no hard lines, nothing. No internet. That seems safe. Unless you physically interact with the computer in the room, you won't be able to hack it. Right? Well, apparently, that's not the case anymore. In the past 2 years, a group of researchers in Israel have become highly adept at stealing data from air-gapped computers. Mordechai Guri, manager of research and development at Cybersecurity Research Center at Ben-Gurion University, and his colleagues at the lab have previously designed three attacks that use various methods for extracting data from air-gapped machines. These methods have involved radio waves, electromagnetic waves, and the GSM network, and even heat emitted by the computers. Guri's lab team now describes their new exfiltration method in a paper submitted to the journal Wired. The title of the paper is "Fansmitter: acoustic data exfiltration from speakerless, air-gapped computers. Yes, Gurry has figured out a way to undermine air-gapped systems using little more than the sound emitted by the cooling fans inside computers. Although the technique can only be used to steal a limited amount of data, it's sufficient to siphon off encryption keys and lists of usernames and passwords, even small amounts of keylogging histories and parts of documents. And it can be done from maybe 25, 30 feet away. The researchers have so far been able to siphon encryption keys and passwords at a rate of about 15 to 20 bits per minute. And that's about 1,200 bits per hour. But they're working on methods to accelerate that data extraction. Gurry states, quote, "We found that if we use two fans concurrently in the same machine, the CPU and the chassis fan, we can double the transmission rates, and we are working on more techniques to accelerate it and make it much faster." It just goes to show that no matter how secure you think your data may be, it probably isn't. And also, if somebody really wants to hack your system, they will figure out a way of doing it. Onwards and upwards. Next story. Okay, the next story is just plain creepy. And I have been trying to come up with some explanation for it, but my rather pathetic hypothesis, as you will see, doesn't really cover it. When something dies, that's it. That's the end. I'm not talking spiritual here. I'm not talking afterlife. I'm talking about our basic definition of life and death. What is alive and what is not. No, I'm not talking about zombies. All right, I'm not talking entirely about zombies. It appears now that once an organism dies, not all of the cellular lights flicker out at once. Writing in the journal Bioprescription, Dr. Peter Noble from the University of Washington reports that hundreds of genes come to life up to 4 days after an organism dies. Some are calling this the zombie genome, and others the thanatotranscriptome, or the postmortem gene expression level. Noble and his team have developed a microarray technique called the gene meter to study the gene expression levels in newly dead zebrafish and mice. You may remember from previous podcasts that microarray profiles can look at the expression of thousands of genes being turned on and off at once, and that they are arrayed on special glass in special plastic chips. Conventional microarray qualifies gene expression by normalizing expression profiles against databases, microarray databases. The new gene meter calibrates the microarray probes in a dilution series, allowing a researcher to match the expression patterns to get a magnified range of expression profiles, like the death transcriptome. Noble says, quote, "It's like calibrating a pH meter," unquote. Using this technique, the team found that hundreds of genes are active following death, some showing expression within half an hour, others turning on 24, 48, even 96 hours later. These late expressing genes were involved in stress, immunity, inflammation, apoptosis, transport, development, epigenetic regulation, and even cancer. Because new molecules are synthesized so long after death, the authors suggest that cells maintain sufficient energy and resources for self-organizing processes to go on for quite a while. Noble says, quote, "We presume to understand the major biosynthetic and metabolic pathways. So when a system is shutting down, the shutdown has to be predictable in the light of those known pathways," unquote. The technique and the results may eventually prove useful for forensic scientists who need to determine time of death, but also it shows potential for testing the quality of organ transplants and exploring donor rejection rates or cancer incidence in recipients. Frankly, I wonder whether turning those zombie genes on isn't done by pathogens resident in the human body. Maybe viruses and fungi and bacteria are all activating those genes in order to help degrade the body. Maybe the processes are not so much shutting things down as getting everything prepared to be made back into mulch. All right, it's just a thought. Yes, it's a gross thought, but still a thought. I told you it was a pretty lame idea. The next story is one that will make Woody Harrelson and Kevin Smith say, "I told you so." Why? Well, as much as we as a society denigrate pot smoking as being a nasty illegal habit, it may have some serious benefits. By the way, I spent a couple of weeks in Oregon last month visiting in-laws, and I wondered from time to time whether I hadn't entered the Twilight Zone. Oregon is among states here in the U.S. that have legalized marijuana smoking for personal, non-medical use. I saw huge billboards advertising various marijuana brands like they were beer or cigarettes. Seriously, I was wondering whether I wasn't on a parallel earth. I had to keep explaining to my kids what this was about. At any rate, health benefits to pot? Maybe. In a new study at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in California, Dr. David Schubert and his group found that tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, the active compound in marijuana, appears to remove toxic buildups of amyloid beta protein in the brain. Those are the brain plaques which are linked with the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Yes, that is amazing if it turns out to be true. Schubert says in a press release, quote, "Although other studies have offered evidence that cannabinoids might be neuroprotective against the symptoms of Alzheimer's, we believe our study is the first to demonstrate that cannabinoids affect both inflammation and amyloid beta accumulation in nerve cells," unquote. Schubert's research came out this month in the journal Aging and Mechanisms of Disease. His team tested THC's effect on human neurons that were grown in the lab to mimic the effects of Alzheimer's disease. So please, please note the work was not done in a living animal of any kind. High levels of amyloid beta are associated with inflammation and higher rates of neuron death. And Schubert demonstrated that exposing the cells to THC lowered the inflammatory response as well as the levels of amyloid beta protein, enabling the nerve cells to continue to live. Schubert says, quote, "Inflammation within the brain is a major component of the damage associated with Alzheimer's disease, but it has always been assumed that this response was coming from immune-like cells in the brain and not the nerve cells themselves. When we were able to identify the molecular basis of the inflammatory response to amyloid beta, it becomes clear that THC-like compounds that the nerve cells make themselves may be involved in protecting the cells from dying," unquote. Receptors in the brain can be activated by endocannabinoids, which are a class of molecules made in the body that signal between brain cells. THC works similarly to endocannabinoids by activating the same receptors in the brain, which produces the drug's psychoactive effects. Further, Schubert says that physical activity leads to the production of endocannabinoids, and some studies have shown that exercise may slow the progression of Alzheimer's. Again, before getting too excited, it's important to note that these results were derived from exploratory laboratory models, not animals. So the researchers will still have to test whether the findings will translate over to animals and humans in clinical trials. I have complained strongly in the past that it takes years before treatments are found to be okay to expose to the public. Yes, the FDA is protecting people, but it's always a question of at what long-term cost. Well, thankfully, Schubert may have already found a way to avoid the tricky regulations surrounding marijuana research in the U.S., thanks to a drug candidate called J147. In separate research, the team found that J147 acts similarly to THC by removing amyloid beta from nerve cells and reducing the inflammatory response. So the researchers may be able to test out these effects in humans without the U.S. government imposing its strict rules around cannabis research. Alzheimer's disease affects more than 5 million Americans, including, unfortunately, my recently diagnosed father. And the National Institutes of Health says it is the leading cause of death, given that the rate of Alzheimer's is expected to triple in the next 50 years. Any research that might give us insight into how to potentially counter its effects can serve to help. In the meantime, well, if you live in Oregon, California, or the Netherlands, well, you know what to do. Next story. If you're a ginger, be careful in the sun. Okay, I can hear thousands of redheads out there saying, duh, Campanella, we knew that. Bear with me, though. As redheads all know, for years, there has been an association between red hair and the increased risk of skin cancer. Mind you, this association has been understood, but no molecular mechanisms for this phenomenon have ever been determined. Dr. David Adams of the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and the University of Leeds has finally found the cause of this relationship. His group reports on the research this month in the journal Nature Communications. Adams found that gene variants associated with red hair, pale skin, and freckles are linked to a higher number of genetic mutations in skin cancers. The burden of mutations associated with these variants are comparable to an extra 21 years of sun exposure in people without that variant. Adams said, quote, "It has been known for a while that a person with red hair has an increased likelihood of developing skin cancer, but this is the first time that the gene has been shown to be associated with skin cancers and more mutations. Unexpectedly, we also show that people with only a single copy of the gene variant still have a much higher number of tumor mutations than the rest of the population. This is one of the first examples of a common genetic profile having a substantial impact on a cancer genome, and it could help identify people at higher risk of developing skin cancer," unquote. Redheads compose about 2% of the world's population, and many carry variant copies of the MC1R gene, and that affects the type of melanin they produce, leading to red hair, freckles, pale skin, and a tendency to burn in the sun. While many individuals with red hair contain two copies of the variant MRC1 gene, investigators in this new study found that even a single copy of a red hair-associated MCR1 gene variant increased the number of mutations in melanoma skin cancer. Moreover, many non-red-haired people carry these common variants, and the study shows that everyone needs to be careful about sun exposure. Adams analyzed publicly available data sets of tumor DNA sequences collected from more than 400 people. They found an average of 42% more sun-associated mutations in tumors from people carrying the gene variant. Adams continues with, "This is the first study to look at how the inherited MCR1 gene affects the number of spontaneous mutations in skin cancers and has significant implications for understanding how skin cancers form. It has only been possible due to the large-scale data available. The tumors were sequenced in the U.S. from patients all over the world, and the data was made freely accessible to all researchers. This important research explains why red-haired people have to be so careful about covering up in the strong sun," unquote. The current study suggests that the MCR1 gene variant not only increased the number of spontaneous mutations caused by UV light, but also raised the level of other mutations in tumors. This suggests that biological processes exist for cancer development in people with the MCR1 variation that are not solely related to just ultraviolet light. Now, my wife is a heterozygote for recessive red hair genes. Her dad had red hair, and she has red highlights in her brown hair, and she has the classic pale pigmentation and freckles of a redhead. Since she is a heterozygote, she is a carrier for at least one of the mutant variant MC1R genes. I know she burns in the sun like an egg on a Phoenix sidewalk, and has already known for years that she needs at least an SPF 20 or better to avoid burns. Last story of the night. Okay, when I first read this, it made me say, whoa. And this is because we often think we know how the world works. We think we know how evolution works. We think we know where we came from. We think we know where we're going. And it appears that we don't. Dr. David Enhard of Stanford University has just published a paper in the journal eLife that basically says that 30% of all protein adaptations since humans diverged from chimps have been driven by viruses. Enhard says, quote, "When you have a pandemic or an epidemic at some point in evolution, the population that's targeted by the virus either adapts or goes extinct. We knew that, but what really surprised us is the strength and clarity of the pattern we found. This is the first time that viruses have been shown to have such a strong impact on adaptation," unquote. As we've discussed in previous science podcasts, proteins are the business end of our genetic code. They perform a vast array of functions that keep our cells going. By revealing how small tweaks in protein shape and composition have helped humans, and other mammals for that matter, respond to viruses, Enhard's new study could help researchers find new therapeutic leads against today's viral threats. Work done previously on the interactions between viruses and proteins have focused almost exclusively on individual proteins that are directly involved in the immune response, the most logical place you would expect to find adaptations driven by viruses. This is the first study to take a global look at all types of proteins. Enhard explains, quote, "The big advancement here is that it's not only very specialized immune proteins that adapt against viruses. Pretty much any type of protein that comes into contact with viruses can participate in the adaptation against viruses. It turns out that there is at least as much adaptation outside of the immune system as within it," unquote. Enhard and his group looked to identify all the proteins that are known to physically interact with viruses, settling on a list of about 1,300 of interest. At the same time, the researchers developed big data algorithms to scour genomic databases and compare the evolution of virus-interacting proteins to that of other proteins. The results reveal to the Stanford team that adaptations have occurred three times as frequently in virus-interacting proteins compared with other proteins. Enhard stated, quote, "The discovery that the constant battle with viruses has shaped us in every aspect, not just a few proteins that fight infections, but everything, is profound. All organisms have been living with viruses for billions of years. This work shows that those interactions have affected every part of the cell," unquote. Since viruses hijack nearly every function of a host organism's cell to replicate and spread, it makes sense that they would drive the evolution of this cellular machinery to a greater extent than other evolutionary pressures, such as predation or environmental conditions. This study sheds light on some long-standing biological puzzles, such as why closely related species have evolved different machinery to perform identical cellular functions, like DNA replication or the production of membranes. Researchers previously did not know what evolutionary force could have caused such changes. Enhard's team was excited by their findings, and they are now using the knowledge to dig deeper into past viral epidemics, hoping for insights to help fight disease today. For example, HIV-like viruses have swept through the populations of our ancestors, as well as other animal species, at multiple points throughout evolutionary history. Looking at the effects of such viruses on distinct populations could yield a new understanding of our constant war with the viruses. All right, let me get up on my soapbox for just a second to annoy the hell out of some of you. I'm a Roman Catholic and a scientist. And yes, I believe in evolution. The Catholic Church has accepted evolution, unlike many Protestant churches, as a mysterious natural phenomenon that has reflected the mind of God for billions of years. Catholic Christians cannot simply accept the universe was made simplistically by fiat 6,000 years ago. That's a foolish cop-out that ignores the truth of science and the world around us. God is more complicated than we can ever imagine in a million years. And a world created by fiat in 7 days does not fit with that complex nature. What am I getting at? For years, I have pissed and moaned about viruses. Forgive the vulgarity, but it describes my feelings fairly closely. Every time I got sick with flu, or my kids got sick, or we even got a head cold, or I got a head cold, I complained. What was the point? And then it got worse. When someone I knew even vaguely came down with HIV, I cursed. What was the point? I screamed silently. Why? Where did viruses come into creation? Why did they exist in the universe created by God, where all things seem to have a purpose? I mean, there are good bacteria. There are bacteria that benefit humans and animals, that help us with yogurt and tofu and pickles. But there are no good viruses. There are viruses that are more harmful or less harmful, but no good viruses. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you tonight a reason for viruses to exist. Yes, I am going out on a limb by talking about teleology. A good scientist has to be very, very, very careful when he speaks in teleological terms, because teleology implies purpose and function. The entirety of biological creation on this earth has depended upon the force of viruses to bring about life as we know it, to bring about humanity as we know it. It simply goes to show that we really don't understand the world we inhabit, and that our Creator is much more subtle than we can ever, ever imagine. Yes, this is a teleological argument. Yes, it's saying that even viruses have their function, that we understand now that viruses are important in evolution. But sometimes you have to go beyond science and talk about teleology. All right. That's all for me from now. As always, take care. I think I've said enough. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.